originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat He's Had Enough.
Raji Baraj aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm joining you tonight from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. I'd like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 201, and also to those of you tuning into our website at horseracingradio.net. As you know, a portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. If you are able to help, please visit their website at www.pdjf.org. So our guest this evening, he's from County Clare, Ireland, and rode races for 25 years before retiring and training on his own. He won the Grade 3 Florida Lee Handicap in 1989 aboard Stoneleigh's Hope and the Grade 3 President's Cup Stakes in 1988 aboard French Comic. With 535 wins and over $8 million in earnings, it's a pleasure to introduce jockey Joe Deegan. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hi, Christina.
Great having you here, Joe. I know you from bumping into you at Churchill Downs a couple months ago, I guess. And
right.
We got to talking, and I quickly thought, hey, this guy would be a great guest on my show. You have pretty cool stories, Joe. Can't wait to hear them all. Now, you're obviously from Ireland. And
right.
Tell us what it was like for you growing up there.
Well, I grew up in the country, and we had nothing to do with horses, but that's how I got into it. There was a horse dealer, trainer. He moved like about half a mile down the road from us, and he had a shop there, and at the back of the shop he had horses and all kinds of horses, and so started going there in the summer when I was a kid, 6 years old, and learned how to ride. And his name was Pat Hutchison. His daughters went on to be very good horse people in Ireland, riders, trainers. There were kids when I was going up there, obviously, you know, but all went on to be successful horse people. Pat was an unbelievable horseman, and he actually, the following year, when I was maybe 7 years old, he took me pony racing in Ireland. We brought two horses, and I won on his one, and that was it. That's how I got into being a jockey.
Were you hooked from that point on, Joe, when you were 7, riding pony races?
I was 7, yeah, when I started riding pony races, yeah. And, you know, it was all because of Pat. And then after that, he got bigger, and he ended up he'd bring 4, 5, 6 ponies to the races every Sunday, and I'd ride them. And that was kind of every Sunday until I went to the Curragh when I was 15 to be a jockey. So I'd been riding races from the time I was 7 years old, you know. And at that time, there was a lot of good riders that came out of the pony racing that went on to do very well. So, and even to this day now, it's even more popular. Still a lot of good riders coming from it, you know. But that was my introduction to it. And once I got the bug, that was it.
That was it. Now, yeah. What first attracted you to the horses growing up right near the horses of Pat's? What first attracted you to that idea of maybe riding?
We were just hanging around as kids, and we started riding the ponies, and that was it. And we used to jump on them bareback and ride them wild, and it was just, I kind of had a natural thing for it, and that was it, you know. None of my other brothers had any interest in the horses, but I was small, and that was it. I just took to that, and really liked it. You know, and the pony racing was a big thing because I was winning a bunch of pony races every Sunday. So that made it a big thrill.
How many brothers do you have?
I've got two brothers, a twin brother and a younger brother, and a younger sister. And I had an older sister who passed away actually last year. So, yeah, so we were a family of five.
Two. I can't imagine your poor mother dealing with two of you. So you have a twin.
Yeah, yeah. He actually did stock car racing at home. So he had no interest in the horses at all.
Wow.
And he drives rally cars around the country. So he likes the fast speed too, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What did your parents think of you at the age of seven riding pony races?
Well, I guess she was still kind of scared, but I just had a passion for it, and I was going to do it no matter what. And then my father bought a couple of ponies for us, and I used to ride them, and I taught a lot of kids how to ride that were in lived not too far from us, and so it was just an everyday thing. In fact, you know, I used to have the racing ponies, and I used to race my brother. He'd have a motorbike, and I'd race him around the field, jumping jumps, and he'd be on the motorbike, I'd be on the ponies, you know.
So, wow.
It's kind of wild.
That is wild, definitely.
Yeah.
Paint the picture for us, Joe. I'm just trying to imagine these pony races, and I've never been to a pony race in my life, so... What kind of, was it over the flat, and how many ponies would gather together and race?
There'd be four or five ponies in every race, and maybe even more than that, you know. And the tracks were kind of put up, back then they were kind of just thrown up, and they put down rope and stakes around the field, and some of them were pretty hazardous, were very sharp and that kind of stuff. And... So you had to be tied on to ride around there, you know, and they were going. It was very competitive. They had the bookies there as well, so people came and bet on them, and so it was competitive, very competitive, you know. And but it was a big thing every Sunday. And the same people showed up every weekend with ponies and kids, and that was it.
Were there many rules when it came to riding those pony races,
well,
or was it pretty much whatever?
You had officials, but obviously they wouldn't be that strict. So there was a lot of race riding in where to be shooting guys off, going into the turn and swinging them wide, coming out of the turn and all that kind of stuff, you know. So you learn to be kind of aggressive early, you know. Yeah. It's pretty wild. It's very, very competitive for young kids riding. It was like the best experience any kid could have for going on to be a rider, you know?
So what were the age and weight limits for the jockeys of the ponies?
Well, on the first race I won, the guy I beat was an older guy. He was like maybe 35 years old or something like that. You know, I was like 7 years old that day. And I beat him, and he'd been winning a lot of races, so that was a big thing, you know. And but usually, mostly you had kids around, you know, anywhere from 10 to 20 riding, you know, 10 or 20 years old, you know. And, you know, and you had the guys there, and they brought their ponies, and they bet on them, and it was competitive, very competitive, you know. But a lot of fun, too, you know.
What about the weight? Did you have to tag a certain weight?
Yeah, they carried weights, and I was able to make the weights easy. So I always had to carry a lead pad mostly. So that was easy for me. I was very light back then when I was a kid. And so I never had to worry about the weight back then. But that changed later on, you know. Yeah.
So
I did that until I was 15. And then I told my mother I was going to be a jockey. And she said, no, you're not leaving school. And I'm like, yeah, I'm leaving. And she's like, no. So I told her I'd go to they just opened the apprentice school on the Curragh. It's just off the edge of the Curragh outside of Kildare Town. And so I signed up to go there, and she okayed that. So that was it. I was gone. I left when I was 15, left home when I was 15. Had a bicycle to ride back and forth to work. And that was it. Derek O'Sullivan was the one who opened the apprentice school. And he was a great guy. Really was out for the kids to try and improve their lives as riders and get better opportunities for the yards that they worked in, because back then when you signed on, your trainer was your boss, and that was it. You had to do what he said. If he said you could ride, you could ride. If he said you couldn't. So you were indentured to him, and he owned. That was basically it back then, you know. But Derek O'Sullivan, he always tried to push for the riders and help them out and get better opportunities for them and more rights and all that kind of stuff, you know. So he was great. He was an unbelievable man, and he was the one who had the foresight to try and help the kids forward their profession, you know. When I was 16, he sent me to South Africa actually for 2.5 months to ride. And I rode there in Durban for 2.5 months, and didn't end up winning the race there when I was 16. But then when I came back, I took off and did really well.
Joe, let's talk a little bit more about, I'm fascinated by the apprentice school started by, as you mentioned, Derek O'Sullivan. And was it like a 2-year program and they started you from the ground up, or did you already have to know how to ride to be in that program?
Well, there was a lot of, it was like a 2-year program, yeah. And there was a lot of kids that came in that didn't know how to ride, and they came from Dublin and they learned how to ride. Used to go to the National Stud there and teach them how to ride. So I was kind of doing that with them, but I'd already been riding from the time I was 6 years old, you know. So, for me, that was kind of boring. But I went through with that program, and but Derek was a great man. He was great. He pushed for to get the apprentices as much as they could. Back then, there was, like I said, you were indentured to the trainer, and he basically owns it. You didn't get paid very much, and so it was, you had to really like it to do it, you know.
Now, after the 2-year program, was your apprenticeship, the weight allowance, was that over?
No, I ended up writing out my claim in Ireland, and I was leading apprentice there, leading bug rider, as they say, there. And next winter, I went and rode in Hong Kong and won a few races there and came back. And when I came back to ride the next spring there in Ireland, I got a fall off a filly, and I was unconscious for 3 weeks, so I missed pretty much the whole year that year. And Kansas State that winter and went back. I was in Miami, and I went back and rode in Ireland that next summer, and I did good. And
I got to stop you for a second, Joe. Did you say you were unconscious for 3 weeks?
For 3 weeks, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. What happened?
Philly flipped over, and I actually didn't have my helmet done up, and hit my head off a stone, and that was it, you know? So it was, anyway, a freaky deal there.
Yeah.
Coming off the gallops on the Curragh, you know?
Gosh, so, that's incredible that you're okay after that. I can't imagine, you know, being unconscious for 3 weeks. And then after such a high, I'm sure, riding in Hong Kong, previously in South Africa, what was it like for you, educational-wise, learning as a rider, a young rider at the time, riding in all these different countries, being around riders with different styles?
Yeah, actually, when I came to the States, I really liked this. And I rode out in the morning for Leroy Jolly. He trained for Bertram Parson, who I came over to, because he had horses in Ireland with the trainer. I was indentured to Dermot Weld over there. And so I came out and rode his horses. I actually got on Genuine Risk when I was a kid. And I used to gallop her when I was a kid in Miami.
Genuine Risk. That's impressive.
I got to know Jacinto Vasquez very well back then, and kind of friends with him ever since, you know. So it was, and then, you know, everywhere you go, you learn from other people and other writers, and so it was. But the traveling was probably the biggest thing. You learn to find your way around, you know.
You mentioned you were indentured to your trainer, Dermot Weld. Now, how long would that contract last? Was it an ongoing?
Well, first of all, it's 3 years, and then I signed up again for another 3 years. And but the second time, I only had my claim for about a year or something after that, because I'd ridden out the claim there. So. But
would you say that's preferred, having a trainer with your contract, over freelancing and just going out and hustling for business? Or which do you like?
I like no contract and going out hustling for business. But back then you had to have a contract with a trainer. You had no choice other than to have one. Now they don't have that anymore. I don't think they have that as much anymore. More or less they have agents back there, and which it was not such thing when I was there. Basically, you had to really scuffle to try and get mounts to move forward, you know. So you had to go and, well, the only way you could do well is if you did well for, if the trainer you rode for put you on something and you won, and then other people would want to use you, and that was basically it, you know.
Were you allowed to ride for other people?
Not all the time, because he didn't want me to lose my claim too quick for his horses. So a lot of times I'd be standing in the grandstand, and I wasn't allowed to ride because, you know, they wanted to use your claim for their horses, you know.
Right.
So that was, yeah. So that's a tough part of it too, you know. Because if you get rolling, it's nothing like being to keep rolling. It just puts you in a different zone, you know. So that part is tough. Was tough over there back then, you know. That's how it was. That's how it was for everybody back then, you know.
Joggy Joe Deegan joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Joe, let me ask you, when you first came to the States, your galloping horses for Leroy Jolly, as you mentioned, got on the likes of Genuine Risk, hanging out with Jacinto Vasquez. I mean, it sounds like you had a great experience. So I'm assuming you wanted to come back to the States.
Well, at the time, I wanted to go back to Ireland because I'd done very well there. And like I said, when I went back, I got the fall, and that really sidewinded me, you know. After the fall, it took me a long time to get it together again. You know, my reflexes just weren't like they were for a long time, you know. So I came to the States that fall and winter after I had that fall, and went back and did well. And then I came to America that winter, and I ended up riding in Aqueduct, and I rode 5 winners in Aqueduct that winter, and I was going back to ride in Ireland and flew home. And as soon as I got there, I decided, no, I'm going back to the States. So I'm pretty much gone on a plane 4 days later and flew back to the States.
Oh, no.
And I had hooked up with Bobby Scanlon, and I went and rode for him. He had horses for Robert Sangster, who had ridden a good few winners for in Europe. And so that was kind of the connection there, you know. And when I came back and decided I was going to move here, it was kind of it was a last-minute decision, and it was just like I made my mind up to do it, and that was it, boom, you know. So it was a big move, but I'd already decided I was going to do it, you know. So
what year was that?
That was in 84, I think.
And for you, as we mentioned, the different riding styles, I'm sure you saw that in South Africa and Hong Kong. What was it like for you, having learned the Irish way of riding, and then coming here to the States, where they have a totally different riding style in terms of how it looks, anyway? How did you adjust?
That was tough. I had to learn to ride with my toe on the iron, because back then we rode with our foot in the iron in Europe. So I had to try and adjust as much as I could, which, you know, I think that's a big thing for the riders when they come to the States, is that you have to look the part here. You know, if you don't look the part, you look different and they don't want to ride you, you know? So that was a big thing. And it was kind of like starting over again, to be honest with you, you know? Even though I'd been here and been there, it was just like starting all over again, you know? So
was
a tough thing.
Was the U.S. way of riding the most different style you'd ever encountered before?
It was, because, you know, the riders here, they have to stay low and be balanced on their horse, you know? Whereas in Europe, the riders ride a lot higher, and they're going a mile and a half, 2 miles, a lot more. So that's a big difference, you know. That's a huge difference. But I think I really like the style here, and I think it's when Cash and Steve Steve Cotton went to Europe, they pretty much changed the style of racing in Europe somewhat, you know. Pretty much every kid rides with their toe in the iron over there now, you know, which was never the case when I was a kid back there. So, but
when you came to the States, Joe, you said you were riding for the likes of Bob Scanlon. Did you have an agent?
He got me an agent. Yeah, he hooked me up with an agent, and obviously went through a few different agents, and then ended up moving to Kentucky, and it was a big move coming to Churchill, because I'd never been there before, but once I got to Louisville, I loved it, so never left. You know, Louisville, it's got kind of everything the big city has without the big city hassles, the traffic and all that kind of stuff. So I really liked it, and the racing is good, and getting better now, as you know.
What was your business like following that move to Kentucky? Did you take off pretty quickly here?
No, it took a while. It took me a couple of years to get going, but then I hit a good run, and I actually win the debutante on a filly. I can't remember her name. And that kind of got me going pretty good.
Well, I know you rode in the Derby in, what was that, 1991, aboard Wilder Than Ever.
Yeah.
Was that your first Derby?
Well, actually, I'd ridden in the Irish Derby when I was 18. So, but it was the Kentucky Derby. I was, obviously, that was the first time I'd ridden in that, you know, any time. And that was a big thrill to ride in it, you know. It's a big thing, you know. So...
What was that like for you riding with such a large field, 20 horses, in front of a massive crowd like that? You mentioned you'd ridden in the Irish Derby, but had you ever ridden with such a large field before?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in Europe, the fields are very big. I mean, you can have 20, 30 horses in a race back there. So the size of the field wouldn't be an issue at all. But obviously, it's so aggressive here. They leave there really running, and it's pretty cutthroat to the first turn, you know. You can get sideswiped, knocked down, whatever, you know. So it's a rough run race, but that's because there's a lot of pressure, a lot of people trying to win it, and that just adds to it, you know. So I think, whereas, you know, the bigger fields in Europe, I mean, they jostle each other around and that kind of stuff, but... because it's not so fast and furious the first quarter of a mile of the race, you can slot yourself in a lot sweeter, you know. But here, I mean, it's every man for himself when they leave the gate, you know. So it's high octane, the Kentucky Derby.
Do you remember your trip during the race?
I do, yeah. I actually took the horse back because he was an outsider, and I just thought, to give him any chance, I'd save him until the last part and see if he could come run a little bit. But he was overmatched in the race, basically. And I'd ridden him in the Derby prep at Turfway, the Jim Beam, and I let him drop out, and he got to run up the rail all the way, and he finished third. So that made him eligible to run in the Derby. And so I kind of opted to ride him the same way because, obviously, you know, in the Derby, you're going to leave there really running. And it takes a really good horse to jump and run the whole thing, you know. I mean, you have to be on a real horse to do that. If they can jump and run fractions 23, 47 and keep going, they've got to be very, very good to be able to do that. So...
Well, Joe, let's take a very short commercial break here. Folks, stay with us. You are listening to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Hi, I'm John Velasquez.
And I'm Julian Lepau. Every jockey knows and accepts the risk of a sport every time they get a leg up on the horse.
Although catastrophic on-track accidents are rare, when they do happen, the lives of the jockeys and their family change forever.
It's up to all of us in racing to support these men and women.
That's why we support the Permanent Disabled Jockey Fund. Since its founding in 2006, the PDJF has disbursed over $8 million to over 75 permanently disabled jockeys.
Over 90 cents out of every dollar donated goes directly to these brave men and women.
They use the monthly stipend to pay bills, hire caretakers, and many other things that make living with a permanent disability just a bit easier.
This is Mike Penna of HRRN. Did you know that the PDJF has no permanent guaranteed funding mechanism and relies entirely on donations from people like you? Please visit the PDJF website at pdjf.org to learn how you can help.
Hi, I'm Ron Turcotte. I support the PDJF. I hope you will too. And I thank you.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
3/4, 1:11 and 3, and they run to the top of the stretch, and Montu is still there. Cool Arrow, the whip, comes out as they straighten away for the stretch drive, and Montu off the turn with a 2.5 length lead. Capture the Glory, tightening up on the Gorgeous Kitten there as they're in the final furlong. Montu, but here's the long shot. Capture the Glory, lunging up to the outside. Gorgeous Kitten down toward the inside. They're in the final 16th. Montu shaking up and responding for Rodney, and Montu will win the 30th running of the rush away, all the way up top in 1:44 and 4.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined this evening by jockey Joe Deegan. Joe, that was a replay of your victory as a trainer of Montu in the Rushway Stakes at Turfway Park in 2017. Rodney Prescott was aboard. I want to talk about that here in a little bit. So you're a successful jockey and a successful trainer, but we'll talk about the training part here in just a little bit. Before we get there, however, I do want to ask you, you've hinted at this a little bit previously. As we all know, the weights in the United States are a little bit lighter than in Europe. That's why you mentioned Steve Cawthon and Cash Asmussen went to Europe, because they were starting to get a little bit too heavy for the weights here. You did the opposite. You came to the U.S., and I want to know, was that difficult for you trying to maintain a lower weight?
Yeah, it was very difficult. And obviously, the older you get, the harder it gets. And the more you try and push the limit, it gets tough. And you can't do anything. You can't go out. You can't do anything. You just got to maintain the weight all the time. So that part is pretty tough. But and then it just got to a point where I couldn't do it too much. I couldn't do it anymore. I was getting on a lot of horses for different people, and breeding horses for Bobby Frankel and Bob Baffert and, you know, all those people. And I kind of got to a stage with the weight where I was just riding some here and there, hand-picking a few that I liked. And when I started riding for Bob Baffert, I win a couple of races for him, and then I was kind of at the stage where I was looking at the horses and, you know, seeing the different individuals he bought and trained, and I think I got clued in then, and I start pinocking yearlings to 2-year-olds for the breeze up sales, and I was still riding some, and kept riding until 2007, I rode my last horse, and I trained it as well. I had 3 or 4 running at Turfway that winter, and I hadn't ridden for the first while because my weight was heavy, and then I decided I was going to drop the weight, which I dropped 20 pounds, and so I started riding again, and I won 2 or 3 races, and the last horse I rode dead heated, and after the offer was over then, but I was taking horses to the breeze up sales at Keeneland, and I took them up there. I was there for a couple of weeks, and then when I got back home and I got in the scales, I was like, boom, I guess I'm done. I was like 15 pounds heavier, so that ruled me out for riding the horse back, and I ran the horse. I put Miguel Manny on him, and we win easy, and that was it for the riding. So,
well, Joe, you
always enjoyed riding and still being on horses, but the weight thing just got where I couldn't do it anymore.
Well, you did pretty good to maintain that weight for 25 years. I mean, that's no easy feat trying to maintain it, you know, and back then, especially the weights were even that much lighter. But before we talk about your training career, I do want to talk about your two grade three victories here. Stoneleigh's Hope in the 89 Fleur de Lis handicap at Churchill Downs. Mike Bell, I showed, was listed as the trainer. I know Mike Bell pretty well. Great guy. Tell us about that horse and that day you won the Fleur de Lis.
I'd been riding a few horses for Mike on and off, and when I got on him in the morning, I had a very good opinion on you know, where they belonged and how they were doing, and Mike liked that, and so he, I can't remember if I can't remember up to Fleur de Lis if I'd ridden him much. I think I'd won maybe a race or two on her before that, and we got a great trip in the Fleur de Lis, and she got up just on the wire. So it was a great day, you know. You don't forget those days.
What did she pay that day?
Mm-hmm.
What did she pay?
She paid, I don't know, something like, it's probably 15 to 1 or something that day. Wow. 12 to 1 or something like that, you know. I think she was like 12 to 1. But she came back then and ran the Ashland and ran third the following summer, you know. So she was a fun filly. Great people that owned her, and Mike Bell, great guy, absolute class act, you know. So it was we always had a good rapport and got on good, and I went, you know, I shipped a few different places and rode races for Mike, and there was a filly that I had talked him into buying, and a filly called Diffidot, and she didn't get to run for 6 months because she injured her spent bone, and then we ran her on Oaks Day, and she was like 14 to 1, and she went by 3 or 4 lengths that day. She went pretty easy. Came back and won a stake at Indiana, and then came back and was second or third in a stake race here at Churchill. So she was a fun filly for Mike too. But that was about that, you know.
What about French Comic in the President's Cup Stakes, the Grade 3 President's Cup, at, out of all places, Axar Ben?
Yes.
I've never been there. It doesn't exist anymore. But no, tell us about that day.
Yeah, Brian Amonetti trained him. And I had one on the horse here, and I went out with him to ride him out there. And he got up and won, and he had a good trip in the race, and worked out good. So it was a great day for everybody. And there was a lot of history back there in Axar Ben. Obviously, Vanbergs were very famous coming from there. Jack's father trained there, was kingpin there, Jack was there. So a lot of history in Axar Ben. But was great atmosphere, a lot of people at the races that day, so it was fun.
Deegan,
as you know, it's always great to ship out of town and win. Nothing like coming back a winner, you know.
Makes traveling worth it, right, Joe?
It sure does. You come back very good. You come back very good when you win, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, horse and rider, everybody, you know.
Jockey Joe Deegan joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Joe, how did you first get hooked up with Bob Baffert?
Just actually, my friend was assistant for him, Johnny Good, and he was living with me here, and so he used to get me to breed some horses every whenever, and that's basically how I got hooked up with Bob. I breezed a horse one morning, and he breezed unbelievable. And the horse was a real quirky horse. And I said to Johnny Good, if you can get me on the horse, see if you can get me on him. I said, you won't get beat. And he ended up winning. It was a nailer down in the fall at Churchill, which, you know, is a pretty salty race for two-year-olds. He won by two or three lengths that day. So that was a fun day, because we all bet a few quid on him, because, like I said, he had worked unbelievable when in the morning, you know. So, you know, just seeing the type of horses that Bob had and the specimen of horse he bought, I think I was just at the age where I was ready for it, you know. And basically that, you know, shortly after that, I bought my first breeze, of course. I gave 8,500 for him and ended up getting 90,000 for him. So that started pinocking, which I still do somewhat, you know. But I've kind of changed from foals to weanings now. But I actually did sell one this year. Wesley Ward bought one for me this year. So if you hit, it's really good. But it's gotten very hard to do it now. It used to be that you could sell them and you mightn't get a fortune, but you'd sell them and you'd move the money along. But now you either get a lot of money for one or you get nothing. So that's a tough thing. But that's how I ended up with Montu. We were at the Classic Tips and Sales, and my friend asked me to go look at the horse and see if we wanted to do a deal on the horse. And I looked at him, and I'm like, well, I really like the horse, but he toes out pretty good in front. It's going to hurt us on selling him. And so anyway, I was kind of wasn't going to do the deal, and then we went for a beer in the bar, and I was like, okay, we'll do 50-50 on the horse, and that's how that came around. And when I had the horse training in that, I really liked him. I took him to the April sale in Ocala, and he breezed good. Like, he went in 10-2, but galloped out in 33 and change, and but because he turned out, nobody really got on him. And so I ended up buying him back myself, and I got two guys to come in with me, and he went on and did very well. So it was a great win when he won the stake, you know. It was very gratifying when they do something like that, you know.
Had to be pretty gratifying, too, if you bet on him, Joe. He paid $36 that day. That's all right.
Yeah.
Worked out pretty well. I want to go back, though, a little bit. Let's talk about that transition for you. And I know what that's like when, you know, for a different reason, but when you are forced to retire, for you it was the weight. After 25 years of riding, it just couldn't do it anymore. And so then you decided to retire. You were already somewhat involved in pinhooking. So for you, was it an easy decision to start training?
It was, because I've never done anything but horses all my life. So it was always going to be horses, no matter what it was, you know. And the pinhooking just kind of snapped into place. And so for about 15 years, we did pretty good at it, you know. Like I said, it got very tough in the last few years, but, you know, it kind of opened other doors, too, you know, where I kind of started buying foals and selling them as yearlings, you know. So if you hit, you can do very well at it, you know. But it was kind of a natural progression. And I still train some, which, you know, I probably always will, because I enjoy it. And, you know, if I can get one to jump up and win, it's pretty gratifying, you know. And usually if I get on and breeze them, I know where they belong. So that makes it a lot easier.
So you,
of course, then there's the thing of getting them to the races, which, you know, you always have issues. You come up with them all. Every horse comes up with something. Get sick, they get the leg, they get this, whatever. It's always something. So you have to have the patience and the will to, if you believe in the horse, to hang in there.
Do you get on all of your own?
I get on most of them, yeah. Yeah, I get on most of them still, yeah. I get on 5 a day probably, you know. So that's kind of enough for me now at the moment, you know. Of course, you've always got other stuff to do as well. So, you know, we're getting on 8 or 9, 10 a day, you're kind of worn up by the time you're, it stops you from getting nothing else done, you know. So, but I enjoy getting on them and see how they're coming along and if they're improving or going backwards or whether I need to press on with one or back off one. So I like it for that reason, you know. I enjoy it still.
How many horses do you have currently in training and where do you mostly run those horses at?
I've got 9 in training at the moment and I've mostly been running at Indiana and Belterra and they've all been running well. I've had 3 wins at Belterra, 2 seconds, and then in Indiana, a couple of winners in Indiana, and a second and a third. So they've all run well. And, which, you know, there's, you know, can't say there's any champions there, but say if they're doing well, and that's as long as they do well and they win where they can, that's what it's all about, you know.
What goals do you have for yourself going forward as a trainer, as a pin hooker? What do you hope to accomplish?
Well, I never really threw my hat in the whole way with the training because I was pin hooking and we were making good money doing it, you know. Obviously, I like the training and I like being around the horses, but it's a costly game and takes a lot of time, a lot of effort. I'd love to get a nice horse, a good one that was a good Saturday horse. That'd be fun for a while, you know. So one that you could get on the plane with. I'd like one of those. So. You know, I'm sure I'll buy 2 or 3 this year, and we'll see how it goes. I always do, you know. So, I've got some selling in September sale, and then I'll buy a few as well, you know. So, we'll see how it all works out.
Do you miss riding races?
Yeah, you always miss that. There's not too many things that are as gratifying as riding. You know, it's a thrill. It really gets your motor running. There's not too much like it, you know. And it's kind of a very addictive when you get hooked on it, you know. And that's why it's so hard for people to walk away, you know, because there's not much else that gets their motor running like riding races, you know.
You said it well, Joe. You said it very well. What do you look for now in your position, having a few horses in training and then you obviously seeking out riders yourself? As a former jockey, what do you look for in a rider?
Just somebody that reads the pace well. And I think that's the biggest thing in any race, is somebody that reads the pace right and place your horse accordingly. It's all about pace, whether it's going 3/4 or 1.5 miles. Somebody that's cool and basically ride a good race, you know. But pace is the key factor. You know, if they're going too fast up front, you want somebody that's smart enough to drop off that pace. If they're going too slow, you want them to press forward and take it to them, you know. So it, once you see a rider reads the race right, then that's good enough for me.
Joe, where do you train out of? Do you have your own farm?
No, I train out of High Point Training Center. It's about 3 miles north or west of LaGrange, Kentucky. So it's about 30 minutes out of Louisville. I like it there because it's they've got a dirt track, which is a pretty good track, and then they have a 5/8 mile up a hill on Polly. I really like that because it gives the horse a break every day from going to the track. And they've also got a big indoor, which we use quite a bit in the wintertime. It's almost a quarter of a mile around it. So you don't have to miss too many days there. But when the weather is very severe, I think it's probably good to miss days, you know. Because when it's real severe, you probably do more harm than good taking away training them, you know. Chuck. I've seen over the years where, you know, at the Spectrum, when the track could be closed, you'd see a bunch of guys start winning races. And then when it warmed up and the track would open again and start training, it wouldn't do as good, you know. So I think if the horses are running, a lot of them are overtrained, you know. But once they're running, you can keep them chipping away and you don't have to do quite as much. You just got to keep them happy, keep them eating, and just get them out of the stall and do something with them, you know. But obviously it all depends on the horse, and if it's a young horse, if it has a couple of races, if they have two or three races in them, you can manage them a lot better, you know.
Joe, what are the changes? You started riding in Ireland and ridden in the U.S. for such a long time. Now training, what are the changes that you've seen in the industry since you first started out?
Obviously, in the States, grass is becoming more and more popular. When I was first here, they didn't have a grass course at Churchill. But it's becoming very popular in the States now, more and more grass racing. The world's a lot more smaller outfits, which they're pretty much starting to disappear now. And it's kind of the same in Europe as well, where the big trainers have a lot of horses, and then there's very few small outfits anymore. Unless they're connected where they can get some good horses, otherwise they've got no chance in Europe. It's so hard over there to win. You're facing, you know, all the Arabs and Aga Khan. Unless you're training for some of those people over there, you almost got no chance, you know. Here, it's not as tight as that here, but you're getting a lot more of the bigger trainers getting more and more horses, and there's just very few less smaller outfits. I'd say even 15 years ago, there was a lot more people that trained at Churchill, whereas now it's, you know, we have maybe Steve Asmussen who have 100 and something there. There's Chad Brown in New York is very big, you know, so he's got probably 200 or 300 horses. Todd Fletcher the same. So there's a lot more of that, you know, whereas back in the day you'd never see that, you know. The likes of Vincent O'Brien in Ireland had probably, I don't know, 60 horses or 70. And never probably any more than that back in the day, but he was so brilliant. He selected the best, he bought the best, and he did the best, you know. He concentrated on smaller numbers and did really well. Whereas now the bigger outfits want more numbers, so they have more access to get a good horse. But he was. Vincent was then going to buy the good horse. He had a great eye for buying a horse, and he was an unbelievable trainer as well. He was so far ahead of his time. He taught about him all the time, and he kind of created the legend it is now with Ballydoyle, you know. But in the States here, it's kind of going the same way somewhat too. But I think there'll always be people that would come with good horses here, and if I have a chance, you know, we can have access to somebody that has the money to buy a good horse. You've got a much better chance of doing well.
Joe, we only have a couple minutes here left, actually, to the show. I want to ask you one last quick question here. You've ridden so many different places. I think you're the perfect person to ask this. What's your favorite racetrack?
Probably the Curragh, I would say. It's a lovely track. It's a big, open, galloping track. Really fun to ride it. You can always get yourself in position there. I always love the Curragh. In the States, probably Churchill here, because it's a lot of action as well. It's great racing here all the time, and I always enjoyed Churchill.
Joe, real quick, what do you do for fun in your spare time?
I don't golf. I was never any good at it, so I don't do that. So pretty much I used to play racquetball. Haven't done that too much lately. But, you know, I don't work out like I used to. So but pretty much horses all the time, you know. Yeah, not that I'm going up to Lexington to look at babies and see how they're doing, maybe speculating, buying something, that kind of thing. So I stay busy doing that. Like when I go to sales, it takes up quite a bit of time, you know? So that's about it.
Well, Joe, I can't thank you enough for joining us. This has been such a pleasure spending the last hour with you, hearing your great story. Wishing you all the best, Joe. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Christina. Thank you.
Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website at horseracingradio.net. Now, I also want to remind everyone that the PDJF will be hosting the annual Saratoga karaoke event July 29th. Check out their website, www.pdjf.org, for more information. And be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thanks for listening.